So I come home from work one night, and I hear this man's voice booming in my kitchen, and I suddenly realize that it was our old Federalist Society stalwart, Mark Levin. I say to my wife, Sally, what is Mark Levin doing in my kitchen? Now, Sally informed me, of course, that... Yes. Thank you, dear. Mark... For those of you who did not hear that Leo household sense of humor, Sally wanted to note for the record that Mark spends more time in the kitchen there than I do. Sally informed me, of course, that Mark had his own radio show here in D.C. It not only reached into the Beltway, but was being aired throughout the country in almost every major city. Well, as Sally has noted, Mark is often in our kitchen now as dinner's being readied, and what I've slowly learned and come to be deeply impressed with is his extraordinary ability to take the rule of law and constitutional concepts we all talk and think about and to communicate them in ways that are more readily accessible and and embraced by a broad cross-section of America. And that is a truly special talent, and one that I know, you know, many of us wish we had to the degree that that Mark Levin has. Mark Levin's New York Times bestseller, Liberty and Tyranny, A Conservative Manifesto, is much the same in its tone and style, if you've listened to his radio program. It is a remarkable treatment of so many of the ingredients of American exceptionalism, including our constitutional structure. The book speaks simply but powerfully about our freedoms and the proper limited role of the courts. And I'll give you just one example from the book. Not too many, so that, of course, you buy it when you're downstairs. The conservative is an originalist, for he believes that much like a contract, the Constitution sets forth certain terms and conditions for governing that hold the same meaning today as they did yesterday and should tomorrow. It connects one generation to the next by restraining the present generation from societal experimentation and government excess. There really is no other standard by which the Constitution can be interpreted without abandoning its underlying principles altogether. And if the Constitution's meaning can be erased or rewritten and the framers' intentions ignored, it ceases to be a Constitution but is instead a concoction of political expedients that serve the contemporary policy agendas of the few who are entrusted with public authority to preserve it.
Damn, that's good.
That's darn good. And that's the kind of prose you'll find throughout the book, and it's the kind of prose that helps people all over this country develop a greater appreciation for the great experiment in self-government that our founders wrought so many years ago. Mark Levin's words, spoken and written, are an inspiration, and they are a call to action to defend our Constitution. And there's no better send-off for all of you as we close this convention, and later today and tomorrow as we go back home to our communities, than to welcome Mark Levin here to leave us with some closing remarks before we move to our closing reception and have drinks. Mark Levin.
Thank you. Thank you. I want you to know what a great patriot Leonard Leo really is. How hard he works. And the Federalist Society is so magnificent. The Libs set up their own society to try and copy. What's that group called? The American whatever?
No need to brand them.
I like the way they put American in everything, but they don't really mean it. Well, this is a serious little time we're in that I want to talk about here. And I want to talk about what I think is key to America's greatness. The key to America's greatness is the civil society. And Aristotle, Cicero, Montesquieu, Locke, Burke, Smith, and the Founding Fathers all addressed it in one form or another. The civil society recognizes the individual as a unique spiritual being with a soul and a conscience. It is built on a transcendent moral order, as Edmund Burke and others described it. The civil society, the individual has a duty to provide for himself and his family. He has a duty to be a good citizen. He contributes voluntarily to the well-being of his community, his church, synagogue, and respects the unalienable rights of others. The civil society has a cultural identity that consists of traditions, values, and customs tried and tested over time and passed from one generation to the next. In the civil society, private property and liberty are inseparable. The individual's right to live freely and safely and to pursue happiness includes the right to acquire and possess property. What is property? Property is the manifestation of the individual's physical and intellectual labor. To illegitimately seize it is to enslave him. A just and predictable rule of law provides the governing framework that undergirds and nurtures the civil society. In our case, the United States Constitution. For the conservative, the preservation and improvement of the civil society is paramount if we are to maintain a humane and free country, because the alternative in one form or another is tyranny. The modern liberal is not liberal at all. The classical liberal is the opposite of an authoritarian. The modern liberal is a statist. That is, he promotes what de Tocqueville accurately described as a soft tyranny. Now, what do I mean by this? The statist is at war with the civil society. He rejects the Declaration of Independence. You notice they never reference it. And that says, in part, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For the statist, individuals pursuing their own legitimate interests, living independent and self-sufficient lives, largely unencumbered by government, is an intolerable condition. And it's about time that we stop giving the statist the benefit of the doubt and accept the fact that he does not share our passion for liberty and the good that flows from it. The statist is basically a malcontent. He's miserable about his circumstances and blames it not on himself but on his surroundings, other people, and society generally. He searches for significance and even glory in a utopian fiction of his mind's making, the earthly attainment of which he believes is frustrated by those who don't share it. So he sets out to destroy the civil society. And that is exactly what Barack Obama and Congress are doing today. On the other hand, we conservatives, we understand that liberty is precious and once lost is rarely recovered. We know of the fall of past republics. We know that the best way forward is not by further empowering an already enormous federal government beyond its constitutional limits, but to return to the founding principles. A free people living in a civil society, working in self-interested cooperation, and a government operating within the limits of its authority promote more prosperity, opportunity, and happiness for more people than any alternative. Conservatism is the antidote to tyranny precisely because its principles are the founding principles. One of the most effective yet pernicious tools of the statist is language. Abraham Lincoln explained it this way. We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not mean the same thing. With some, the word liberty may mean for each man to do as he pleases with himself and the product of his labor, while with others, the same word may mean for some men to do as they please with other men and the product of other men's labor. Here are two not only different but incompatible things, he said, called by the same name, liberty. And it follows that each of the things is, by the respective parties, called by two different and incompatible names, liberty and tyranny. Now, for the statist, tormenting us, controlling us, dictating to us, seizing from us, is explained as liberty. For the rest of us, it's tyranny. The statist misuses the word equality to great effect as he pursues uniform economic and social outcomes. And in this regard, he promises to make that which is imperfect, perfect, and that which is impossible, possible. And only if you surrender more and more of your liberty and property to him. Only then can his utopia, such as it is, be achieved. Consequently, the statist rejects rights as being unalienable. Instead, he assumes the authority to determine who has rights and who does not, and then rations them accordingly. Last year, in his commencement speech at a college, a graduating class at a college, Barack Obama made the point. He said, "Our individual salvation depends on collective salvation." But salvation is not government's to give. It is not a grant to mankind from mankind. Under the wrong conditions and in the wrong hands, this deviant view is a powerful tool against humanity. And yet this is where we are today. Although the soft tyranny has been building for decades, the most brazen and dangerous war against the civil society is being waged, as we gather here this evening, by this president and this Congress. They are scheming against the individual, liberty, private property, the rule of law, and ultimately future generations. And they are pushing on multiple fronts. In less than 10 months, the president and Congress have in effect nationalized many of our largest banks by using TARP funds to buy their stock. They have eviscerated the nation's bankruptcy laws by turning Chrysler and GM over to the UAW, an unsecured debtor, and strong-armed secured investors. They're nationalizing the student loan system. They're claiming the power to dictate lending terms offered by mortgage companies and interest rates by credit card companies. They're dictating management salaries and bonuses in certain industries, and seek to compel unionization of workforces across most industries without a secret ballot. The President and Congress have used the recession to launder tens of billions of dollars in a phony stimulus bill to their favorite political constituencies, including ACORN, the SEIU, and politicians and bureaucrats in state and local governments. In fact, so irresponsible, gluttonous, arrogant and ideologically driven is this administration and Congress that they adopted a budget that will create nearly $12 trillion in debt over the next decade, with the Congressional Budget Office declared unsustainable. And that's if we experience 4% growth every year, which we won't. Otherwise, it's closer to $21 trillion over the next 10 years. This was done at the same time the Federal Reserve pumped trillions into the financial system. So current fiscal and monetary policy have turned America into the largest debtor nation the world has ever known. It threatens to destroy our currency through inflation, the full faith and credit of the United States government, and the liberty, opportunities, and security of future generations born and unborn. And that is a contemptible disgrace. And they're not done. As further evidence of their compassion and good deeds, the President and Congress are in the midst of nationalizing 17% of our economy, better known as the healthcare system. The government has already run up over $55 trillion in unfunded obligations for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid entitlements. Now, how do they justify this? Well, everyone should have affordable quality healthcare, right? And the only way to accomplish that, of course, is for the government to take it over. Everybody wants something for nothing. And that's what Obama and Congress are promising, something for nothing. Now, have you noticed that the statist can't quite get his propaganda straight? On the one hand, he promises national health care that will ensure quality care for all Americans. On the other hand, they say we spend too much money on health care and we need to cut it. Well, which is it? Do we spend too much or do we need to cut it? Writing in the left-wing New Yorker, a fellow by the name of John Cassidy, who poses as an economist, had something very interesting to reveal. He wrote, "So what does all this add up to? The U.S. government is making a costly and open-ended commitment to help provide health coverage for the vast majority of its citizens. I support this commitment, and I think the federal government's spending priorities should be altered to make it happen. But let's not pretend that it isn't a big deal and that it will be self-financing or that it will work out exactly as planned. It won't. He wrote, many Democratic insiders know all this. What is really unfolding, I suspect, is a scenario that many conservatives feared. The Obama administration is creating a new entitlement program which, once established, will be virtually impossible to rescind. At some point in the future, the fiscal consequences of the reform will have to be dealt with in a more meaningful way. But by then, the principle of universal coverage will be well established. Even a 21st century Ronald Reagan will have great difficulty overruling it. Power at all costs. The great Milton Friedman explained, once the whole population is covered by health insurance, there's little political incentive to increase spending on medical care. Once the bulk of costs have been taken over by the government, as they have in many other countries, the politician does not have the carrot of increased services with which to attract new voters. So attention turns to holding down costs, that is, rationing. Now, for the status, this is the ultimate authority over the individual he has long craved. Once the individual is entrapped, the status controls his fate. The individual will be seduced by the notion that he is receiving benefits from the state, when in reality, the government is simply rationing benefits. The individual is tethered to the state, relying on it for his health and survival. Not only does the government have an ownership interest in his private property, but it has one in his physical being. Now, I should emphasize the extent to which statist policies are demonstrably devastating. Let's look at the environmental movement. The environmental movement became prominent in the early 1960s with Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. Carson was an opponent of pesticides. She asserted that the chemical DDT, which had been widely used to eradicate malaria, including in the United States, Europe, and Canada, destroyed wildlife, including birds, and exposed children to increased rates of cancer. In a 1972 case brought by the Sierra Club to ban production of DDT in the United States, an administrative law judge at the newly established Environmental Protection Agency found, after listening to months of testimony and evidence, that DDT was harmless to wildlife and people as used under the regulations. But his decision was overruled by the EPA administrator, William Ruckelshaus, a great hero of the left. He's one of those Republicans that they love to talk to, who hadn't heard or read any of the evidence, yet he banned it. As a result of this decision, many other industrialized nations followed the U.S., and DDT became unavailable to the Third World. And that has led to the deaths of millions and millions of poor children in Africa and Southeast Asia. Rachel Carson remains an icon. Her home is a historical site if you ever want to go visit it. And the Sierra Club remains a favorite media source for expertise. Now, when Obama and Congress talk about CAFE standards, they rarely talk about the human toll of lighter trucks and cars. In 1999, USA Today reported that 46,000 people had died in crashes they would have survived in bigger, heavier cars since 1975. Since then, Congress has further increased the CAFE standards with precious little concern for the carnage they are mandating. Environmental extremism, ladies and gentlemen, kills. And now on to global warming, which they now call man-made climate change because the Earth is cooling. The President, Congress, and the EPA want to define as a matter of law, not science, carbon dioxide, which you exhale as you breathe, as a pollutant, which in turn must be reduced and regulated. And without getting into great detail, most of you are very smart out there. As you well know, the Supreme Court had a role in this as well, but I'll save that for another day. And in order to do this, the federal government would have the power to dictate carbon dioxide emission levels and fine and punish those who exceed them. In essence, this would empower the government to dictate economic and personal decisions at virtually every level. And keep in mind, carbon dioxide is actually a very small fraction of greenhouse gases. And greenhouse gases are part of the atmosphere. If we didn't have greenhouse gases, this planet would freeze. Now, let me give you an example of how minuscule carbon dioxide is. If you had a stadium with 10,000 seats, carbon dioxide would account for 4. And that the reason they focus on carbon dioxide is it's the only part of the greenhouse gases they can actually measure. You know what the biggest greenhouse gas is? It's water vapor. It's kind of hard to control water vapor, but my guess is they'll try. Reminds me of the Kellogg-Briand Act of 1920, whatever it was, when everybody got together and passed a law outlawing war. Did you know that? War is illegal. Anyway, despite the evidence, Congress and the administration are hell-bent on using junk science to get their hands around our society and control everything from the light bulbs we are legally permitted to use in our homes to livestock flatulence. Now, as I wrote in Liberty and Tyranny, so distant is America today from its founding principles that it is difficult to precisely describe the nature of the American government. It's not strictly a constitutional republic, because the Constitution has been and continues to be easily altered by a judicial oligarchy. No offense, Judge. By a judicial oligarchy, excluding you, that most enforces, if not expands, the statist agenda. It is not strictly a representative republic because so many edicts are produced by a maze of administrative departments that are unknown to the public and detached from its sentiment. And it's not strictly a federal republic because the states that gave the central government life now live at its behest. So what is it? It's a society steadily transforming towards statism. And if the conservative does not come to grips with the significance of this transformation, he will be devoured by it. That said, in the face of this onslaught, it would be suicidal for us to abandon our principles. We must teach these principles. They have been passed to us from past generations and have proven themselves throughout history of mankind to be the right principles. Now is not the time to compromise. Who shall we compromise with? Which principle shall we surrender? And to what end? If we can't stand up to this soft tyranny, then when will we stand up? Now is not the time to lower our voices. Now is the time to be heard loud and clear. And if we are not resolute, given what's going on today, then when will we be resolute? You are all intelligent and motivated folks. Your society is under attack. Our governmental institutions are being used against us. I know it upsets some people when I talk this way, but we don't have time to play word games, in my humble opinion. We don't have time to deny reality. These people are trying to dispirit you. They're trying to overwhelm you. They want you to accept their agenda as inevitable. They want you to give up, but we're not going to give up. See, I'm not yelling, I'm just talking. You're booming. Now, you're extremely crucial for this battle. You are the generals, whether you like it or not. It took decades to get to this point, and it will take decades to contain and unravel it. The statist never gives up, and neither can we. We must become more engaged in public matters. It is our nature to live and let live, to attend to our family, to volunteer, and to quietly assist a friend or a neighbor, even a stranger. These are certainly admirable qualities that contribute to the overall health of the community and the civil society. But it's no longer enough. I like that song. Is that a New Deal song? When the Saints Come Marching In? What is that? All right. Happy Days Are Here Again? Okay. Now,
Well, he was so inspired.
He was. Now, if we're to win this struggle, it will require reinforcements. It will require a new generation of activists, larger in number, shrewder, and more articulate than before, who seek to blunt the status counter-revolution. And I mean counter-revolution as counter to the American Revolution. More conservatives than before will need to seek elective and appointed office, fill the ranks of the administrative state, hold teaching positions, become judges, advocates, become school teachers, university professors, find positions in Hollywood and media where they can make a difference in infinite ways. The status does not have a birthright ownership to these institutions. We must fight for them, mold them, and where appropriate, eliminate them. Parents and grandparents must take it upon themselves to teach their children and grandchildren to believe in and appreciate the principles of the American civil society and stress the importance of preserving and improving this society. They will need to teach their offspring that the status threatens their generation's liberty and prosperity and to resist ideologically alluring trends. And in this regard, back to this all-important issue of language, the status has also become masterful at controlling the public vocabulary. For example, when challenged on global warming, he accuses the skeptic of being a denier, favoring corporate polluters or being against saving the planet. Draconian measures that threaten liberty and prosperity, such as cap and trade, are marketed in appealing and benign slogans, such as going green. The status never destroys, he reforms. He never disenfranchises, he empowers. President Reagan understood the power of words. He deconstructed the status propaganda and framed the debate on his own terms. Here's an example. He once said, "How can limited government and fiscal restraint be equated with lack of compassion for the poor? How can a tax break that puts a little more money in the weekly paychecks of working people be seen as an attack on the needy? Since when do we in America believe that our society is made up of two diametrically opposed classes, one rich, one poor, both in a permanent state of conflict, and neither able to get ahead except at the expense of the other? Since when do we in America accept this alien and discredited theory of social and class warfare? Since when do we in America endorse the politics of envy and division?" We can beat these people. We can beat them if we engage them and we use our heads and we use our knowledge. Now, some on our side want us to forget Reagan. I say we still have much to learn from him. Now, let me close with a final quote from Reagan. It's an excerpt from a speech he gave entitled "Encroaching Control, The Peril of an Ever-Expanding Government." He said, and it's in the book, so many of you may have heard it by now, "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same, or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States where men were free. So we all need to get busy." Thank you very much. Do you want me to take any questions?
Mark is very happy to take questions, so people should begin to line up at the microphone there.
Mark, congratulations, and keep up the wonderful work that you're doing. As a faithful Federalist and strict constructionist, I have been inspired here at this weekend seminar and all the programs, but one thing still troubles me. With regard to enemy combatants, and I certainly agree that the wrong thing to do is place them on the continental shores of the United States, but for those who are enemy combatants, what far window period should we hold them without giving them some military tribunal? Is it 5 years, 10 years, 100 years? And I would think that even under the applicable Even if the Warsaw Convention or Geneva Conventions were to apply to enemy combatants, which I don't think they do, at some point there should be a close of a window to give them some adjudication.
Do you think they should be executed?
Well, I mean, if we can...
In other words, if we have this military commission system and we go through it and all the appeals, would you agree that capital punishment applies to them?
I would.
Okay, then I'm all for it. The point...
Well,
hold on. Let me just say this. I find the question a little perplexing. Not you, but I hear it all the time. It's the enemy that's deciding how long this process goes on, not us. And we have people in prison. They've had trials and so forth, domestic criminals in prison for their entire life without the right to parole and so forth. And, you know, we're talking about wartime. And the wartime rules are not the same. Well, I guess they are now, but they weren't before, before yesterday. The wartime rules are different. This is a great American tradition, started with Abraham Lincoln, who I thought Obama was, carried out by FDR, who I thought Obama was. He's the first president of the United States, first president in history, to reject the military tribunal system and to bring a lawful enemy combatants, that is terrorists, under the umbrella of a federal civilian system. And we have federal judges here, and they will tell you what a nightmare this is going to be to try and figure out what the rules are, the due process rules are, in the middle of a game, particularly since these people have already been interrogated without lawyers. What next? What's interesting about that question, which is a good question, is I keep hearing even the left say, well, we have a good Justice Department. I'm sure they'll be found guilty. I'm saying, now, wait a minute. So this is a ruse. So we're going to go through this whole thing, even though we know they're guilty, you know they're guilty, and you hope they're found guilty. But anyway, yes?
Sure. With some trepidation. I think that it looks to me like the bloom is off the Obama revolution. The voters now understand that there's something wrong with their Democratic representatives in Congress. But they also think very poorly of their Republican representatives
right.
in Congress. And there's a generation of candidates out there who are beginning to think about how to respond to this voter demand for some kind of cleanup of Washington, D.C. And I wonder what advice you would give to candidates who want to try to make not only a policy difference but an ethical difference in the way Washington's run.
Well, I'm all for it. Let me just say this. I think conservatism is without question on the rise. If we can continue to articulate our principles, these arguments you're hearing in these rallies, these are conservative arguments. And it is very, very crucial that these folks be brought into the conservative slash libertarian fold, or they're going to fire off into the Ross Perot Reform Party mode, in my humble opinion. Now, the problem is, while the electorate is having real serious problems with what this government is doing, we don't have a we can't reach them until next November. And they know that. And like I was saying, these people are committed. These are true believers we're dealing with, as the great Eric Hoffert would have called them. And so they are prepared to take political casualties in the next election if they can impose their pipe dreams. And keep in mind, when they do impose them, if they do, you know, we're disenfranchised. It's going to be very difficult to get at them and get at these issues once they impose them. So it's crucial that we have some important victories in the next election and the following election if we're going to contain it. Now, as for, what we need are conservatives to knock out rhinos in the primary and take over the Republican Party. That's what the whole Reagan Revolution was about. That's what 1976 was about. That's what 1980 was about. It's not like, you know, we're having to reinvent things here. Let's state our principles. I love this idea. It's a big tent, except, of course, when we conservatives decide to enter it, then it's not a big tent anymore. Then it's right-wing extremist Klansmen. But anyway, I view the Constitution as a very, very big tent, and that's my answer. Constitution is what we stand for. It's a big tent. Come join us. What you stand for is something different. And no, we won't join you over there. Yes, sir.
Could you comment on the degree
yes.
of... Yes. Thank you. The degree of difference in this current crop, in this administration, with previous either Clinton, Carter, Johnson, Do you see a difference in kind and degree in their tactics, their skill?
Or yes, I see.
People, or are they more adept at doing things?
Well, you know, it's a harder tyranny than there was before. And, you know, we have people who wear the word Mao right on their chest pretty much. So it is definitely a different breed. But that said, there is a logical progression of what's going on since FDR and so forth. What's happening here is there is a huge push to get it done as fast as possible. Let me put a footnote to that. They're never done, but it's a huge push to get as much done as fast as possible. This election, I've said this on the air, and I think somebody just wrote about this. This election was a fluke. We had an awful Republican candidate. We had the economy tanked at exactly the wrong time from a political perspective. You have a media that was goose-stepped behind the Democrats, whether it would be Hillary Clinton or Obama. Well, it's historic. You know, everything they do is historic. And he only got 52.7% of the vote. And so they're doing everything they can as fast as they can. And if you read Saul Alinsky, what this really is an effort to diminish the middle class and to create, as best as possible, really fundamentally two classes, an oligarchy and then the rest of us. You don't have to believe me. Read Saul Alinsky. Obama studied this stuff.
What else?
As time goes by and things get worse and worse, in your opinion, at what time...
I feel like this is a suicide hotline or something. I don't do that, but go ahead.
Well, I'm looking back in the time of Samuel Adams, and I'm just wondering, in your opinion, at what time do we go and throw the tea in the harbor?
Well...
In other words... Sometimes.
Not today, and not with me around, I can tell you that. Those things work their natural course. Nobody's going to say it's this date or that date. And as I said, I view this as more of a soft tyranny where you can't put the kind of light bulbs you want in your house or the kind of toilet you want in your house or whatever. That's kind of, you know, a government that has the power to tell you what kind of toilet you can have is a very, very powerful government. But that said... that day may or may not come. I have no idea. I'm pretty pissed off, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yes.
The statist has his own vision in opposition to the civil vision of society as a civil association that we have. But he is not merely a person grabbing individual power and all of that, although that is occupies them. There is also a transcendent ideology on the other side that motivates these people beyond an immediate expedience or personal advantage, though there is plenty of that. And that is, in opposition to the notion of the civil society, is the vision of our society as a kind of enterprise association in which the society has certain goals and objectives and that the citizen is obliged to conform to them in the interests of the greater good. And the theory there is that if we pursue this, we will bring about a millennial world at the
right.
end. And so
right.
this is a direct descendant of our New England dissenting religious traditions. This has a long history down through the progressive movement. So I think to understand this, we need to consider that the opposition has itself a transcendent vision of society as a vehicle for the pursuit of ideal ends.
All right, may I interrupt you?
Yeah, just a second. Just 1 second.
We all know this, with all due respect. We
okay,
all know. And the problem is, I do not see these as relative philosophies, which is what you're getting at.
No, I am absolutely not.
Well, that's what I'm hearing. They have a transcendent... Evil has been around since the beginning of man, if that's your point, and that's exactly right, and it comes in different forms. I use the word statism to cover all of them because I didn't want to write a 500-page tome that nobody would read. So I called it statism. It could be Marxism. It could be a fascism. It could be National Socialism. It can be Democratic Socialism. You name it. But they all grow out of the same theory, the one you're talking about. We can call it progressivism. which everybody likes to do because that was very popular in the 1800s and the early 1900s here. The bottom line is that it is a form of tyranny. And when I speak to people, and this is what's important, I have to speak in plain English, and I have to get through to people, and I have to explain to people why they are threatened. And if I go through the whole history every time I speak to them, starting from Plato all the way up to today, which I'm quite familiar with, we'll all meet in a telephone booth and it won't make any difference.
You can't do that, but at the same time, I think you do need to convey that there is a powerful idealistic drive behind their mistaken approach, and that is why they are so persistent.
It's not a mistaken approach. It's a conniving, vicious, strategic approach.
Agreed.
All right, my friend.
You mentioned a moment ago how there's a logic to what is going on right now that goes all the way back to FDR and the New Deal. And I think a lot of us...
He's actually right. It goes further back than that. But I bring it up to the New Deal because most people understand that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of us in this room, the arguments we would make in opposition to this would also point to the overthrow of the New Deal and the Great Society. And I think, I don't know if we can ultimately win without making those types of consistent intellectual arguments. So I guess the question is, how can Republican politicians
Let me help you.
Win incrementally
okay.
while still making that case?
Well, that's a different question, Republican politicians. I'm not a Republican politician. The first thing we need to do is get our arguments straight. Social Security's broke. Medicare's broke. Medicaid's broke. They're going to crumble. It's just a matter of when. The New Deal is a failure, and it's a failure because you can't have those three programs alone with $55 trillion in unfunded liability, where the controller of the United States, before he left, David Walker, made the point that this is going to destroy our society if it isn't addressed in some significant way in the next few decades. So if we hang around the next few decades, the programs are going to collapse on their own, and the New Deal will be proven a failure. The problem is all the misery that goes down the drain with it. So to come up with practical arguments, I can think of one. I mean, I can go back to some of the arguments that have been made by people other than me, but that I like, which is you start to wean people off of these programs. People who are already on Social Security and Medicare, I mean, where are they going to go? The government promised them these programs. They've paid a lot thinking that these are insurance, which they're not. And so you just basically have to bite the bullet and accept the fact that there's a significant percentage of the population that is on these programs and will remain on these programs. But what about a 21-year-old today or 25-year-old or 30-year-old today that wants nothing to do with these programs? We need to reach those people and give them options, private sector options, market options. And we can do that. And I firmly believe that we do not spend enough time focused on the young people in this country, the next generation, because that's the generation that's getting screwed the worst. Yes, sir.
Hi.
Hi.
Wanted to ask about
I'm a health. Little hard of hearing, so let me hear
okay.
you.
Okay. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask about health care, health insurance reform. I didn't know this prior to the debate, but someone cannot currently purchase health insurance across state lines. I was just wondering if you knew the reason why that is. And secondly, what is your take on why Congress has not just repealed that law?
Additional
would drive down
the
cost.
Well, one of the reasons we have the Interstate Commerce Clause was to prevent exactly that, because states... when we had the Articles of Confederation, forget about insurance, they weren't honoring contracts in other states, they weren't honoring taxes levied in other states, they weren't honoring the currency of other states, they were developing their own armies and all the rest of it. And so the Interstate Commerce Clause was supposed to put an end to that. It was supposed to promote commerce, not limit it. Congress created this situation, actually, after a Supreme Court decision. They talk about, well, we're going to take the antitrust thing away from the insurance companies. The insurance companies never asked for it. The states asked for it because the states wanted to regulate the businesses within their own borders. And that's how that developed. And so the problem is that if you're an insurance company headquartered in New Jersey, you are compelled by that state to offer certain types of benefits as part of any policy that you offer. Okay, well, great. South Carolina says, not here. You're not going to do that here. You're not going to do business here. And so over time, that's been developed. So what people like me, and I'm not the only one, certainly say, people who've studied this a long time, is we need to get rid of that. We need to follow the Interstate Commerce Clause, the Commerce Clause, promote commerce, promote competition, get rid of these state monopolies, and unleash free enterprise rather than regulate it to death. And that's just one thing. And you know, there's like four or five things that if they were done would make a huge difference in how we develop healthcare policies and pay for healthcare in this country that would over time lower prices and increase competition. I understand the president's going to have a summit in December on how to create jobs. Thinking to myself, oh my God, you haven't figured that out yet? I mean, we know it's not the stimulus. We know it's not tax increases. Maybe it's tax decreases. We know it's not more regulation. Maybe it's less regulation. But they're so ideologically committed to their big government agenda, they're never going to promote competition between states. What they're going to do is wipe out all the state regulations and centralize it under some commissioner. And I want to be that commissioner so I can make sure I can get the health care that I want. Yes, ma'am. Is this all you expected from me, Leonard? Are we doing okay here?
You're doing great.
All right, thanks.
Most of us are lawyers here, and I think we're able to understand.
Any slip and fall lawyers here? No, go right ahead then.
We're able to understand and discern some of the threats that you've talked about. And I understand that you've been on a book tour, and I think you were in Long Island.
No, right? I went to two places.
Long Island?
Long Island.
Okay.
And Tyson's Corner. I was traveling America. From Long Island to Northern Virginia.
Real bellwethers. Mark.
Yes.
By the way, I promised I would let you know that Lieutenant Benjamin Vargas of the New Haven Fire Department drove out to Long Island from Connecticut and said he stood in line for 4 hours and still couldn't get to you, which tells me that a lot of people were waiting to see you. And I was curious if
I was there 7 hours.
If you can tell us what you're hearing from, you know, like working people and middle class people, and what they're able to discern, because, you know, as lawyers, we see things a little differently.
Fair enough. Well, you know, this phrase, middle class, I've never accepted, and I'll tell you why, because I don't know what it means. And I write about that too. Is a 28-year-old paralegal working in a Manhattan law firm and an atheist earning $85,000 a year, Does that person like the family of five in northeastern Philadelphia, a mechanic who's a union member who earns $45,000 a year? They're both in the middle class. This is all Marxist crap. The middle class, this class, that class. I will tell you this. The people are upset. And they're upset for a lot of reasons. In some ways, Obama is doing some of our work for us because he's taking what a lot of people have relied on, like Medicare, created by his ideological forefathers, and turning it on its head. I mean, you can't take $500 billion out of Medicare without destroying it. It's that simple. The unemployment rate, which is effectively, when you consider people taking part-time jobs and people who've dropped out, 17.5%, 10.2% if you just take the people who are out of work, is so high in the industrial heartland of the country, which is a very blue area. There's such an enormous opportunity for an articulate conservative on the national scene to take advantage of this from a political point of view. Because we have answers that I think are far superior than anything the other side does. We know they don't because they've basically had a blank check to do whatever they want, and it's a failure. So to answer your question, yes, there's something percolating, and it reminds me, it's worse, but it reminds me of the Carter era before Reagan won. that people are ready to throw the bums out, and they don't care who the bums are. They're that furious right now. I mean, I'll be honest with you. When I did two book signings, and we had 8,000 people show up at each one, and I sat there for 7.5 hours and didn't move at each one, and I couldn't finish, I knew in March something was going on, something was up. Yes, sir.
Sir, would you mind commenting on what you see as the threats to liberty posed by the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which this current administration intends on ratifying?
Well, we don't want international bodies determining how we raise children in this country, and that's the bottom line. I don't want international bodies doing a damn thing, to be perfectly honest with you. And the reason is, and by the way, I didn't originally necessarily get into all this UN thing. I thought those people were all a bunch of kooks, too. But then, you think about it, the effort of the left, they would like nothing more than to have decisions made about our nation's sovereignty and what goes on within our nation to be made by these international bodies, international tribunals, and so forth, in order to impose on us views of people who don't share our culture and our traditions and our values, and to separate us and our ability to affect them at the ballot box by making these international arrangements. Now, I believe in some international arrangements, of course, military, diplomatic, but I do not believe issues that are to be decided by the citizenry through their elected representatives should be sent offshore under any circumstances. And you know, the purpose of a society is to preserve itself. If we can't preserve ourselves, then what are we? If we can't preserve this society and our traditions and history and our law, then we're nothing. And this is a chipping away at that. This whole global citizen thing deserves a little bit more thought. I can promise you that the dictators who run China think nothing about being global citizens. I can promise you that the Castro brothers think nothing about being global citizens. In other words, our enemies view this time in American history as an opportunity to pursue their own interests, the interests of their own nation state, and they're not thinking globally unless it has to do with acquiring as much power as they can. So I don't like all these international arrangements which involve us ceding law and authority to people we don't know in tribunals that we have no control over. Yes, sir.
Sir, what are your thoughts on how society today has become centered around the state, in that whenever we have a problem, we've been trained to always think the government must solve it, in contrast to the founding fathers who viewed the family, the church, the individual as the center of society, and there's where we solve our problems? And does this not also help explain why the statists are always so hostile towards morality, the family, and religion? Because they really view the family and religion as rivals and obstacles to the tyranny of the state that they're trying to carry forth.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think there's a lot to that. And that's the war on the civil society. That's at least part of it. you know, let's take religion for a second. Do you think a single colony would have, and that's what they were, I mean, they became states, but they were colonies before, would have ratified the Constitution under the current notion of separation of church and state? Do you think a single one would have ratified it? No. Now, does that mean we support states having religion as an official religion? No. And it's a phony argument, because states stopped having official religions about 20 years, 30 years after the nation was founded. The people of the states wouldn't tolerate it. You know, there's so much magnificence that we're surrounded by as a result of liberty that it's impossible to catalog it. You know, we don't even, the general we don't even recognize it. And yet, you see, statism is very tangible. I will give you this, I will do this, I will do this. And often we're in the position of saying, no, leave us alone, we'll figure this stuff out. Leave us alone, we'll handle it. And that's the frustration so many of us have, that liberty is something we can talk about, and liberty certainly has consequences, but and its consequences are tangible, but in explaining it, you know, first of all, you have to have an IQ over 14, and secondly, If you're a drone who just loves whatever government benefit you're getting, you're not going to be open to listening to it. Does that make sense? Of course it does. Yes.
One of the things that made Reagan, I think, so effective was his optimism about the country. And, you know, it's a pretty dark time for conservatives. And, you know, we get cast as being angry, which I think there's a lot of reason to be angry right now. But do you have any just advice or thoughts on sort of how to maintain a kind of optimism which is attractive to independents and people that...
I don't think our candidates lack a smiley face. They all walk around with smiley faces. They're all nice enough people. And I don't think that's our problem. I think our problem is we don't have a conservative. You know, a candidate who can articulate our principles. And the more attractive that candidate is, I'm all for it. But I have to tell you something. If you listen to Reagan's speeches when he was campaigning for Goldwater, he was not very happy. He was very angry. But do I think it's better to be positive and happy? No, of course I do. But right now I would just like to find an articulate conservative who can speak in complete sentences.
Yes,
is this
sir.
A Jerry Lewis marathon here? What are we doing here? Yes, go right ahead.
We have three minutes.
What do you call it? Telethon,
minutes.
Yes.
This room here is filled with Republicans and libertarians alike, conservatives. But each time we're faced with a race in which there is a Republican and a libertarian, one siphons votes from the other and we're bound to lose, which we saw happen in New York recently. How should we be moving forward now to ensure that we're not split the way the Democrats have been split for so long?
Well, we need to nominate free market conservatives. That would help. Again, you know, this really isn't rocket science. It was done only, how many years ago was it? Reagan ran. There you go. 29 years ago. And I think libertarians, an authentic conservative libertarians would support. Now, as for the 23rd, I'm thrilled about what happened in the 23rd. We prevented a left-wing phony from becoming a member of Congress, where she would have sat for the next 20 years and been unable to remove. She lost and revealed herself. Suddenly, she wasn't for a big tent. She came out for the Democrat. And this guy Hoffman, as inarticulate but authentic as he is probably going to run again and probably win. So, you know, these electoral victories, you don't necessarily win them all at once. You've got to build and build and build toward a momentum and pick them off here and there where you can. I mean, we didn't win every seat in Virginia, but we won a hell of a lot of them. 2 years ago, we got slaughtered. Who would have thought would have happened in Virginia? What happened in Virginia? There's counties in New York that people aren't talking about where well-entrenched leftists or liberals were thrown out. So, you know, we just have to keep at it. And I honestly believe that the conservative and there are huge differences too, but where they overlap, conservative slash libertarian philosophies are extremely attractive philosophies if you explain them properly. You know, if you tie them to everyday life. Yes, sir.
This will be the last question.
Attorneys who have not only taken oaths in support of civil society, but for many is it actually a calling to do that. But what would you suggest for people in this room to say to people who reply, the house is on fire, and there is even a point where the firemen run out of the house instead of running in? Better to let it collapse and rebuild later.
Well, they have their wish right now. Isn't that what's going on? I mean, what's it going to take? You got $12 trillion that he just imposed in debt, which is likely going to be $21 trillion. They're destroying the currency. They're trying to destroy the healthcare system. I never thought in my lifetime the GM would be owned by the government and the UAW. They're taking over the student loan system. They've basically taken over the interest rate decisions for credit card companies. They run the mortgage business in this nation. People don't seem to realize that. They're not done. They want to do their cap and trade. I'd say the house is burning right about now. It's time to turn the hoses on it. All right, you're the last one. Don't screw it up.
Mark, longtime listener. It's a
first-time caller. Thank you. Yes.
I was just curious, your first book, Men in Black.
Yes, sir.
What sort of feedback have you gotten from the judiciary about that?
Well, the judiciary isn't in the business of writing letters to authors, are they, Judge? I don't think so. But that was a very, very difficult book to write, because given all the decisions and all the history with the judiciary and all the criticism I knew I would face if I didn't write a 10,000-page textbook that nobody would read, you know, making sure that I hit every precedent, I just decided to do what I wanted to do, which was to go into the heart of some of these major areas and address them. The only little criticism I got were a couple of whacks on the left, you know, who were saying, well, you say judicial review isn't in the Constitution, and yet you say that the court shouldn't have done or should have overruled X, Y, and so forth. No, what I said was judicial review is not in the Constitution. It's an implied power, and therefore it should be used very, very carefully. And then the cases where I said it should be used, I thought I explained them as best as I could. But, you know, that book has stood the test of time. It's amazing. I get callers now that cite, you know, it came out in 2005, that talk about that book. But then again, I was trying to take an extremely complicated set of cases and history and put it in as plain of English as I could to try and, you know, that book sold over 250,000 copies on the Supreme Court. And I remember Charles Lane was a reporter at the Washington Post. Now he's an editorial writer. He's actually a pretty decent guy. I've only talked to him once in my life. That's why he's a decent guy. But he did a story on this Georgetown or George Washington law professor. No offense, professors. I can't keep track of all of you guys, to be honest with you. One of these professors who wrote a book and was getting all these book reviews. Oh, it's the greatest book. It came out at the same time. He sold 5,000 copies. So Charles Lane wrote the piece. He said, this book gets all this attention from these book reviewers, and Levin's book got no attention. Liberty and Tyranny was not reviewed by a single major metropolitan newspaper book review page. Not one, by the way, I didn't ask them to because I knew what they'd do anyway. Not one offered to appear on any of the morning shows, any of the Sunday shows. They pretend it doesn't exist, and this should give you hope. Because 1.1 million copies later, it doesn't make a damn dime's worth of difference what they think. God bless you.